Coming up next on This Week in Computer Hardware, DX12 is apparently the revenge against Mantle. WD Purples, is it April Fool's already? Lenovo's latest X Series, a $4,500 gaming laptop, RAM help, GPU upgrades, and more. It's all coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twitch.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 256, recorded February 27th, 2014. DX12 is coming.
This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by iFixit. You can fix it, and iFixit makes it easy with step-by-step repair guides, high-quality replacement parts, and all the tools you'll need. For $10 off your purchase of $50 or more, go to iFixit.com/twit and enter the code TWITCH at checkout.
Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, Twitch weekly show that aims to bring you the most useful, most informative, most helpful, and most thoughtful news and information about computer hardware, tablet hardware, and yes, ladies and gentlemen, once in a while we'll even talk about a phone, but we will not talk about wearable computers, at least until we do. Joining me as always, Mr. Ryan Strout from PCPer.com, who is going to do his best to pay attention to the podcast, but the University of Kentucky is in overtime right now against Arkansas. What's the score, man?
I'm not going to look because it's going to be upsetting. I do want to point out that you always put a lot of pressure on us at the beginning of the show. You always make it like we always have to have this informative, helpful, whatever, all these superlatives that you add on to the end of it. Where if you just said, hey, here's a show about hardware, then we don't have much to live up to, and every show can be deemed a complete success.
Okay. Right?
So
let me restart.
Maybe going forward, we lower our expectations a little and roll with it.
Hold on. Let's do it over. Welcome to This Week in Computer Hardware. I'm Patrick Norton, and Ryan Trout and I are going to talk about stuff, mostly computer hardware stuff. Ryan?
Yeah, perfect. Yeah, no, that's good. That's great. Way better. Yeah, we'll just use that one going forward, and not that big a deal.
Let's talk about DirectX 12. I don't know why I'm trying to say DirectX, but. It's funny. DirectX 12 and a new OpenGL challenge AMD Mantle coming at Game Developers Conference. I thought DirectX was dead after 11. Dead.
Yeah, a lot of dead. People said that. A lot of people said that.
Including a lot of people I thought inside of Microsoft, because hey, you've got an Xbox One. Maybe you can upgrade it to DirectX 12. What the delete expletive is going on with Microsoft and their newfound attempt to control access to gaming hardware? And how is AMD reacting?
Well, it's an interesting thing. So AMD Mantle was designed by AMD to be an efficient API. It lets the developer get closer to the metal with less API, with less software overhead. Essentially, you'd be able to get better performance out of your graphics system, out of your processor, out of the system as a whole, right, if you had less of this kind of software baggage that is unnecessary for a lot of areas, right? And they can do that because they were able to focus on one single graphics architecture, their own, right? They don't have to worry about consoles. They don't have to worry about mobile phones or tablets or anything like that. That's like, we're going to focus on graphics, one architecture, the GCN architecture. Now, I don't know how long that was in development for or what all the background is on that, but a lot of people for at least I would say all of 2013 and a lot of 2012 were kind of under the assumption now that DirectX 11 dot whatever was going to be the last release, and we would get maybe occasional updates and performance changes. And, even AMD came out at one point last year and said, yeah, as far as we know, there's no DirectX changes coming on the roadmap, right?
Dun, dun, dun.
Yeah, and then we suddenly get the reveal of Mantle. So it's probably not a coincidence that those two statements were made last year by that same company. But what is interesting now is GDC is coming up in March in your neck of the woods. I'll be out there for a 2 days for GDC out in San Francisco. And there are some sessions that show up as they do with these conferences. You get a little bit of a heads up about what the sessions are and what the topics are. And like one of them is titled DirectX evolving Microsoft graphics platform, and they use terminology like, you asked us to bring you even closer to the metal and to do so on an unparalleled assortment of hardware so you can squeeze every last drop of performance out of your PC. Come learn our plans to deliver, right? And then another session called DirectX, Direct 3D Futures, says things like an unprecedented level of hardware control and reduced CPU rendering overhead. Now, those things are probably word for word were written about Mantle after it was announced, right?
Right.
So it's very curious to see the overlap here in these potential things. Now, what we don't know for sure is if DirectX is, if it's going to be, so it seems fairly obvious from these that there's going to be a new version of DirectX. It's going to try to address lower level hardware, like it's going to let you get closer to the hardware. It's supposed to remove some overhead on the processor, but we don't know how they plan on doing that. Are they doing that by, you know, maybe they're going to segment DirectX to here's the console version, here's a high-end PC version, here's a low-end PC version and laptop version, and try to limit the amount of hardware that each version of DirectX has to address? Are they making a lot of changes to the API in the same way that AMD did with Mantle, right? It seems that seems more likely to me that they started to hear rumblings of what was going on at AMD, and they realize that without DirectX being, if for some reason DirectX would suddenly become the non-dominant API, that it could do a lot of bad things for their business model, not just on the PC right. side, but on the console side. I'm assuming it's going to be a full new revision if you get DirectX 12. What it does for AMD is even today, it puts a lot of questions into our minds about, okay, is Mantle worth developing for now, right? If Microsoft's going to come out with a DirectX that has close to the same levels of access to hardware across not just AMD hardware, but AMD and NVIDIA, maybe Intel, other vendors' hardware, then why would you want to develop and like constrict yourself into one vendor's platform, right? I think it's unfortunate for AMD as they were just now starting to get the ball moving with Mantle. Battlefield 4 was released, but it was delayed. Thief was supposed to be released with Mantle support. That was delayed into next month sometime. So they've already had, like, they've had enough setbacks as it is. They don't need this kind of coming out and being hung over their head as questioning why does a consumer really want to buy an AMD piece of hardware specifically for Mantle if they think that DirectX 12 is going to do the same or similar types of things for AMD hardware or NVIDIA hardware. They'll still be able to maintain that, you know, choice and selection. The thing is we don't know for sure. Like, next month we'll know, maybe not for sure, but I don't expect this is something that, you know, at GDC they'll just be like, and it's available today. You can download the SDK and games are already being developed. I don't think it's going to be like a quick, like immediate process. It maybe not, it won't even happen in 2014. It may be like an early 2015 to mid 2015 type product release. But you've got to start working into, okay, if DirectX 12 is going to be announced, are we going to have new hardware revisions for that? Right. Cause like new GPUs are usually built around major DirectX refreshes. So when will that happen? When will that cycle happen? Will some of that feature set be backloaded into what you get with current hardware, right? Some of the overhead issues and all that. Because that's one benefit Mantle has, is it works and will work on HD 7000 series cards and a lot of stuff that's already out in the market. But I think it's going to be really, really interesting to see what Microsoft says and how they say it at GDC, and then after they make their announcement, going to talk to game developers, going to talk to NVIDIA and AMD and say, well, now what? Right. And I'm sure NVIDIA is just doing dances on tables about this, because that's been like the one thing people have prodded them about. It's like, hey, what about AMD's got this Mantle stuff? Why are you still limiting yourself? Why aren't you developing your own API? Why aren't you doing all these types of things? And now, you know, they may have an out through a Microsoft DirectX update.
I mean, it's
funny because, you know, Titanfall is launching. We're supposed to have Twitch support coming online for the Xbox One. It's already been announced that the Xbox One doesn't appear to support 1080p on some of the more interesting features on the Xbox One. You know, part of the reason everybody thought DX11 was going to be sort of the end of DirectX for the foreseeable future is because the Xbox One and PC gaming and being tied together was so critical. Man, I'm really curious to see how this evolves, because the console battles, I think, are going to get really ugly, especially since the Xbox One's got such a disadvantage in terms of cores and available GPU processing power. You know, it's...
You know, and that could also be part of the reason that they would want to refresh DirectX, right? Because Mantle doesn't run on the Xbox One, even though it uses AMD hardware. So Microsoft might be looking for a way to procure more performance out of their console hardware to help bring it up to, or maybe above, the performance level of the PS4, right? PS4 depends on OpenGL, and that's a large consortium, open source, like, you know, lots of things have to happen for that to move forward, but it's also a little bit more flexible. But Microsoft can just refresh the tool set and say, boom, now everything has changed, and maybe that will help out there too. And if PC gamers get a benefit from it, then I think that's great. And if it, you know, Mantle was really cool, but nobody likes the idea of these proprietary one-off systems. You know, I don't like PhysX because of that. You know, 3D Vision was limited because it was like that. Even though we like G-Sync, we would love for it to be across all GPU vendors. You know, seeing Mantle be replaced by a vendor agnostic version of the same thing would be good, in my opinion, bad and, you know, for AMD, but that's the way it runs sometimes.
Ladies and gentlemen, I have been transitioning, I will say, to use a nice word, to a new laptop here in the office. And I thought to myself, you know, I've been moving around a lot of laptops lately, and, you know, it always amazes me how frustrating it is when you move that slightly different keyboard layout and that slightly different touchpad experience when you bounce from laptop to laptop, which is almost an elegant segue into the Origin PC Eon 17 SLX gaming notebook review. Haswell GTX 780M SLI. This sounds like an absolutely ripping machine you guys had in for benchmarking. How heavy is this thing?
I think it weighed in at, let me see here. I thought I put that in there. 9.5 pounds for the laptop alone.
and Core i7-4930MX Haswell, basically four cores, eight threads, 16 gigs of DDR3, 1600, a pair of SSD drives, MSATA SSDs in RAID 0, plus a Western Digital Black, you know, 17-inch 1080p screen, a 6X Blu-ray reader, Thunderbolt, because... You know, somebody other than me should be able to use Thunderbolt in this day and age. And dual NVIDIA GeForce GTX 780M 4 gigabyte cards. This is a freaking $4,500 gaming laptop.
Yeah, that's a lot.
You know, and you could replace this performance with what, $2,000 worth of desktop hardware? Is that a cruel thing to say? Or is that a
not really? It's realistic. It's realistic.
Right.
The Core i7-4930X 39MX is interesting, even though the model number sounds like it would be a like an Ivy Bridge E-part. It's not. It's Haswell, like you mentioned. The two GTX 780Ms are essentially full GK104 chips, so GTX 770 or GTX 680 equivalents on the desktop. So you're getting, you know, two full performance desktop parts on this system. And then, like you mentioned, the RAID SSDs and all that. The Thunderbolt port is interesting to me in that we almost never see Thunderbolt implemented on laptops. And even on, I don't know, it kind of makes less sense on this, but it's still a mini display port option. So you can use it to connect, you know, external monitor, which we did when we did our gaming testing. It also kind of maybe if you worked at a business and you did a rendering, you know, you worked in CAD a lot and you could somehow convince your work that this was a high performance.
It's an editing machine.
Editing machine. Yeah. Right. Like, it's got Thunderbolt. I can hook up our that RAID thing you also have to buy at the same time for storage, right? Maybe it helps cross a boundary between a mobile workstation and a mobile gaming machine. But it's hard to swallow a $4,500 price tag. I mean, there's no getting around that.
I mean, the entry level on this series is $2,000.
Yes. Right. I mean, this is essentially the highest priced version that you can get on this. The processor is a big price jump. The 780s mm-hmm. are definitely a big price jump. I would almost never recommend, like, the two 780Ms will be used, right? You can see in the benchmarks that you can run 2560 by 1440 on this and you'll get great performance out of it. The processor, you don't need the $800 mobile processor, and there's probably there's a $300 option there, so you can take $400-$600 off the price by going with the lowest end. It's still a quad core hyper threaded part,
right?
So that's an option, you know.
I'm gonna ask, what was the battery life like?
It was low. I mean, if you look at the picture of the of the bottom of it with it open with the heat sinks and the fans, the battery in the middle of the bottom there. Yeah.
There's like $100 worth of copper in this box.
Yeah, there's a lot. You've got the processor in the middle and you get the two GPUs on the outside. I mean, it gets fairly noisy when everything's cranked up as well, as you'd kind of expect looking at the fans. Chances are you'll be using headsets or have this hooked up to speakers, but it's also a little bit disappointing because you can't, I guess you could, but most people won't have this laptop like stored under the desk where the noise is further away, right? It's kind of interesting to see what you get for that kind of money. I mean, able to run Metro Last Light over 50 frames a second at 25x14 at maximum quality settings for a mobile machine is damned impressive. It's just the kind of, if you are going to buy a $4,500 gaming notebook, you already know you want a $4,500 gaming notebook. It's not like a conversation where we can have and convince people that they should or shouldn't do it. Like, this is something you already know. Like, if you're going to buy a $300,000 sports car, that's fine. Like, your decision has been made.
It's just which $300,000 sports car to buy.
Correct. Right. And there are other vendors other than Origin putting out $4,000 and $5,000 gaming laptops, clearly. And it's just impressive to see. It's one of those things that, in my opinion, is not very relevant to 99.99% of the audience of us or our website or anything, right? But it's just really cool tech to see. It's always cool to see how much performance can we cram into a mobile form factor. And it's mostly mobile.
I think it was PC Per Fan in the chat room who pointed out that getting all of that power in a 10-pound package that runs off of batteries that will fit under your arm is still pretty badass.
Yeah.
With
the screen, right?
I want to build a gaming PC into my car now. Because I think I could buy a used car with a decent sized battery and put a desktop in it with almost as much power, game indefinitely, at least until I ran out of gas, and probably spend less money. I don't know. It's awesome. It's way too expensive. I'm much more excited about the Lenovo ThinkPad X240, which is the third in their series of Ultrabooks. Were you carrying an X220 or am I pushing too much on you? 230.
To be completely fair, I did have before that a 220 and before that a 201.
You are a big fan of the X series.
I have been. I definitely I bought into it for the battery life. I stayed with it because of the durability of the machines. Right. They have just, nothing has ever gone horribly wrong on the machine. And usually with like highly dependent technologies, like my laptop that it goes with me everywhere, that is one of the key things is do not screw up. So
I love the fact that it's like a Core i5 4200U, 8 gigabytes of DDR RAM. You know, I'm a little less than enthralled with the Intel HD Graphics 4400, but they sip the power. 12.5 inch, 1366 by 768. Was the resolution? Did you feel that was a little low, or do you feel it's just about the right resolution for a 12.5 inch screen?
Right. Because it's a 12 and a half inch screen, I don't really knock them for it, but it does seem pretty low. And to be fair, this is kind of the same resolution. I was checking my mind. Mine's still 1366. I have 768. It's been that way for a long time. And if there's one area that maybe could be upgraded, if you could put a 1600 by 900 screen resolution on that, you know, Windows 8.1 has a lot more functionality in there for increasing, you know, if you have a higher density screen, a pixel screen there. I think personally, I'm getting a little bit out, falling a little bit out of love with the 12.5 inch real estate for keyboard and screen. Right. But I love the battery life and the thinness still. So the X240 is still up on my list.
What's the battery life like on this laptop? Because it's funny, it's such a tiny battery compared to some of the other ones we've seen. It's like a three-cell battery, I think.
So what's interesting about this, I think this is the first time they have done this, at least on the, well, on the ThinkPad, the X line like this. The machine has an integrated three-cell battery, like inside the machine, you can't access it or get to it. But for external connections, you have the option of a three-cell battery additional or a six-cell battery additional. So minimum you're going to have is six cells with the machine, and it'll be completely flush and still an Ultrabook form factor. And if you get the six-cell, it becomes a little bit thicker. Now your total is nine. And the battery life on that is kind of nuts. Like if you do the battery life, battery eater readers test, you're talking 18 and a half hours with, the combination, the largest combination battery there. And then if you only have the three cell external, so six total, you're down to like just about 10 and a half hours of battery life. That's a lot. That's a lot. And in fact, the reviewer, the guy, Steve, who wrote this review, even kind of, you know, mulls over the idea that 18 hours of battery life is like a lot. Like that's a lot. And maybe they could have used a little bit higher performing components to make up for that. Like maybe let's lose 2-3 hours of battery life to get, you know, a higher speed processor or something like that, you know, and obviously that's a decision that some people won't agree with. And I think I'm one of those people, but it's an interesting idea, right? At what point is battery life, you know,
that was 18 hours.
I don't think we can get there. But.
That was 18 hours with the internal and external cell, or 18 hours off just the internal cell?
That was total. Yeah.
Okay. With all the batteries.
Yes. All of the batteries.
Sorry. I'm just, you know, I it's funny. Like what would you have updated to get more power inside of the laptop?
I think he's talking about using a higher performance processor, right? Okay. The Core i5-4200U is not bad, but it definitely, like, if you look at some of the performance graphs, it's like everything is using the same processor. Everything is using the same base platform. So, like, the performance is identical between, you know, four, five, six laptops in our testing at this point. I think it'd be interesting to offer options both ways, right? But then... I don't know what you get into. I mean, in reality, the X240 is really targeted at mobile business users, mobile, you know, productivity users. You know, they're not. It's not aimed at gaming. The HD4400 is not going to do anything positively in that regard. But if you want a machine, if you like, I'm going to fly to China next month and I'm going to take a laptop with an 18-hour battery. That sounds amazing to me. That sounds like the best idea. Another thought we had was batteries, as they age, lose some of their battery life, right? They tend to shrink some of that. So if you start out at a higher peak, you know, you get, you know, in 2 years, maybe, you know, if your battery loses 25% of its capacity, then you're starting at a higher level. So therefore you will maintain higher levels throughout the life. I think, I'm not sure of the science behind that, but that's my I think a reasonable estimate for that. But I don't know. It's a good machine. There was a couple of things he wasn't super keen on, the change in the trackpad, for example. So if you're if you're interested in the Lenovo X240, go check out that review. He did a really, really good job of laying out all the changes between that and the previous models of the X line.
Alan Malventano checking in with the Intel SSD 730, 480 gigabyte, the overclocked data center SSD for the enthusiast. It was funny, it's an Intel SSD. They've been doing this for like five years at Intel. And if you look at the pictures, there's a beautiful rollout there, sort of everything from the original, I want to say XM25, but scroll down a little bit to the crazy graphics on that new SSD.
Skull man.
So it's funny. So 2013, Intel introduces its own native SATA 6 gigabit per second solution, which went into their data center line of SSDs, which were expensive. The S3500 and the DC S3700. Alan says, while preparing that review, I remember saying how that controller would be a great consumer unit if they could just make it cheaper and tune it for standard workloads. And it appears his wish has been granted. Behold the SSD 730, which is that crazy-ass skull picture. 240 gigabytes, 480 gigabytes, obviously not an entry-level SSD unless you're entering at the higher-end level. Sticker in the box, Speed Demon solid state drive, which I just kind of laugh about because, you know, Intel, Speed Demons, flames. The performance is looking pretty good.
Yeah, it's not winning the benchmark races, but it's in the mix. It's in the mix for sure.
You know, less than $1 a gigabyte they expect. Because it's funny, these are on pre-order now. You can't buy them yet. Pre-order for March 18th is when they'll be available. 5-year warranty, rated at 70 gigabytes of writes per day. final thoughts. Intel has a track record of overlapping parts among their consumer and enterprise lines. They did it with the X25E, the X25M, with the SSD 710, the SSD 320. And now they've repeated that trend with the DC S3500 and the SSD 730. But the SSD 730 carries the full 5-year warranty like the enterprise parts and, quote, actually beats its enterprise cousin thanks to its controller running at a 50% overclock. Unfortunately for the SSD 730, that formula also caused it to inherit the S3500's power consumption, which may lead to uncomfortable temperatures when used in low airflow environments. The highest IOPS figure they've seen at low Q depths. Question, Alan says, is if a 7 to 10 times power draw as compared to the closest competitor is worth the marginal gain in performance. Still got a gold award. It's a badass SSD, sucks a lot of power compared to its competitors. Interesting stuff. It's a curious
I love the idea of an overclocked SSD, though.
Yeah.
And I think it's like going back to the old days of when you had the turbo button, because the clock speed goes from 83 megahertz to 100 megahertz. Yeah. So that's the overclock that we're talking about, which is nice.
There's a good on the performance over time trim and temperature page. I particularly love the spot thermometer checking the temperature of the drive. 122 degrees Fahrenheit. This is not a laptop part. And Alan says, just keep scrolling down. You'll see it. It's such a beautiful shot. And Alan says, hey, in Intel's defense, they are marketing this as an enthusiast desktop SSD and make no claim to mobile usage. So if you put it in your desktop, make sure you've got a fan sucking air over it in a big way. I'm just saying. There it is, 122 degrees. Or use it as a coffee warmer, which is kind of tempting. Cooling things down, the Antec Cooler H20 1250 all-in-one liquid cooler review. Maury wrote this up for PC Per. There's been a lot. It seems like everyone's making a pre-assembled liquid cooler these days. Or is that just me?
No, it's not just you. It does seem like everybody is making them. This one has an interesting design. If you look at the the second picture on there, there's actually two different pumps on it, one over each fan, that are on like a push-pull configuration, right? So it's actually pushing the fluid through at a little bit higher pressure, maybe not higher speed, but higher pressure than otherwise. So it's kind of interesting to see how that works. It unfortunately didn't really change performance levels very dramatically. Right. The cooler H20 1250 did okay, but not great. Didn't stand out that well. And Maury had a little bit of trouble with the installation process. Mm-hmm. Apparently, like one of the brackets is made out of plastic, and it actually cracked on us, you know, in the fourth or fifth time of taking it off and putting it back on, which is maybe not something that end users would deal with, but that's still definitely worth mentioning, right? It's like it's bad. And Antec said, when we asked about it, they said, it's not a normal thing. We'll send you out a replacement. This is what we do for normal customers as well.
I mean, it's interesting. I had a relatively inexpensive air cooler with a plastic mount that broke. Now, admittedly, I carry my PC from home to work probably more often than a normal human being. But, you know, I really, really, really prefer metal holding my heatsink or my cooler down to the motherboard. And it's funny, you know, looking at the performance on these, like Thermalright Silver Arrow, you know, 12 degrees at idle, 35 degrees at low. The water coolers, they're having a tough time with a lot of the water coolers. At least to me, looking at a lot of the coolers I'm seeing, there's not a huge, I'm just not seeing the performance I'd like to see for the money you're spending compared to an air cooler.
Yeah, things seem to be leveling out a bit on that regard. So, they're still good devices. Maybe not this of all the ones that I've used. This is probably not the one that we would recommend right away, obviously. But I don't know. They're still neat. They still have good aesthetics, and some of them can be quieter than the regular heat sinks you use. Not all of them, but some of them can be quieter too. So.
Western Digital, they have greens, they have blues, they have blacks, they have Enterprise REs, the ones named after dinosaurs. Then came the red series, which is for your NAS boxes. And now Western Digital launches the purple series of 3.5-inch hard drives, which are surveillance oriented.
It sounded odd at the time, didn't it? It still kind of does.
Go ahead.
The idea is being able to write a lot of streams simultaneously is something that hard drives will have problems with. This is not for if you have one or two cameras at your office or at your house or something like that. Like a standard hard drive will be able to handle that. They're talking about like 32 separate individual, you know, recordings at one time.
Right.
And those are the types of streams, right? And so by tweaking what technology they built into the red, they are able to kind of make sure that, I think what's the metric they have in here, the purple has much smarter firmware that's been tuned for the specific purpose, seeing above 50% idle time when handling 32 HD streams. So
it's a lot of streams.
It is. It's a lot of cameras to be recording all at one time.
It was funny because Robert Heron actually had recently installed a 15, 18 camera system for a charity he works for. And I was laughing. So I was looking like this would have made his life so much easier. But it's funny. It's funny to watch Western Digital look for more and more areas where they can make targeted products, probably because, you know, I would imagine they're looking at, as SSDs drop in price, they're probably looking for places where they can really notch out a niche that is defensible. It's interesting stuff. It's, you know, I'm still laughing a bit about it, but the efficiency is pretty interesting.
It'll be interesting. We're getting a couple comparison in and working on a couple of scripts to kind of test this functionality and see how different it is actually from other hard drives. So we'll be able to talk about it again later.
Okay. We should take one more story at least.
Sure.
We did the anti-cooler. We should actually talk about the Moorfield and Merrifield that have officially unveiled. Or actually, should we take a moment to thank our sponsor?
Let's go ahead and thank our sponsor.
iFixit. This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by iFixit. You can fix it, and iFixit makes it easy, people. If you've never been there, I highly recommend it. iFixit.com is the free online repair manual for everything. They started out with, you know, like Mac notebooks and desktops and MacBook laptops. And then they expanded into phones and iPods. And now they are the free online repair manual for everything. They have step-by-step repair guides, foolproof instructions to fix all your stuff. If you shattered your laptop screen, you need to repair your game console or swap the battery on your tablet or smartphone, iFixit has got you covered. You've probably seen their teardowns. They actually tear down new hardware as it comes out. They give a ranking for how repairable it is, how easy it is to upgrade. It's pretty amazing. They did them for the Xbox One and the PlayStation 4. They've done them for pretty much every major phone that's come out in the last few years. They have 10,000 repair guides for everything from electronics like your smartphone, your tablet, your game console, home appliances, clothing, even, ladies and gentlemen, your bicycle. They can hook you up with the parts you need to fix it. And everything they sell is tested and guaranteed. And iFixit makes the most trusted repair tools for consumer electronics, including the ProTech Toolkit. I actually have one of these, an earlier version of it that doesn't have the really, really cool roll. Mine came in a plastic toolbox, but the ProTech Toolkit has 70 tools to assist you with any mod, malfunction, or misfortune that comes your way. The gold standard for electronics work, from garage hackers to the CIA and FBI, but more importantly, their unique tools are used by repair technicians everywhere. There's a 54-bit driver kit in there, which I cannot recommend enough. As somebody who spent years collecting random collections of bits, you know, they have Phillips bits, the stupid little pentalobe bits that iPhones and Mac laptops use now, Torx security bits, tri-wing bits, triangle bits, really nice swivel top precision tool, a driver, and an extension, a flexible extension that makes it easier to reach, you know, those buried screws and PCs and appliances. You know, you look at that kit, that rollout kit there, they've got electrostatic discharge safe tweezers. They've got a collection of spudgers. If you're the kind of person that uses a wrist strap to prevent static issues, they have an anti-static wrist strap in there, along with the nylon spudgers. That's basically spudgers, by the way, are things for poking things. Nylon spudgers, metal spudgers, the tools you need to open up all sorts of different tablets, you know, or scraping off the top of a heatsink mount. And the tool roll is really, really nice. You know, the toolbox I have a whole bunch of other stuff stuffed in there. A tool, the roll is just, it's small, it's stuffable, it fits in a desk drawer really, really easily. And it's easy to clean, people. This is a fantastic deal for an incredibly useful collection of tools. And look, it's not just for your consumer electronics. If you're a hobbyist, you know, if you've ever had to dig a part out of a carburetor, this could be useful for you. Pulling pins or straightening out pins on freaking weather pack connectors, doorknobs, eyeglasses, cabinet doors, sinks, fixtures, and so much more. If you're looking for a treat for your favorite artist or hobbyist, this would be a good one. Ladies and gentlemen, with iFixit, you can fix it yourself. Visit iFixit.com/twit for free step-by-step guides. iFixit also sells every part and tool you'll need. Plus, if you enter the code TWITCH at the checkout, you'll save $10 off any purchase of $50 or more. That's iFixit.com/twit and use the code TWITCH. We want to thank iFixit for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware and for making some pretty badass tools for fixing things. Many's the time I have saved hundreds, if not thousands of dollars on laptop and phone and iPod repairs with the help of Twitch. Excuse me, iFixit. For some reason I was saying Twitch. It's just like a brain to fail, just like yes. That. Mobile World Congress. Lots of phones.
Yeah.
Lots of wrist devices.
I didn't feel like we needed to talk about a whole lot of them, or, you know, like the Samsung Galaxy S5 came out. Tegra Note 7 LTE was announced. There was a couple of phones using Tegra 4i that were announced. Qualcomm had some announcements. Everybody that's, you know, making phones and tablets had some announcements. One I thought was interesting was the Merrifield launch announcement, release, whatever you want to call it. This is the migration of the same microarchitecture that is inside Bay Trail, which is a chip that came out last year meant for tablets and small clamshell devices. Merrifield and Merrifield are based on the same microarchitecture, but for cell phones and tablets, right? So smartphones and, you know, lower cost tablets, maybe smaller, thinner, lighter ones. Right. What's interesting about this, so it's using the same Silvermont architecture. So it's the all new out of order architecture that differentiates this from anything previous with the Atom name on it. These are still being branded Atom. These are the Atom Z3400 and Z3500 series processors. They're like Merrifield is the smaller version. It's targeted at smartphones. It's the dual core variant. Moorfield is the quad core variant. They also have slightly different GPUs. And that's kind of the most interesting part for me is Bay Trail used Intel HD graphics for its GPU engine. These are actually back to using PowerVR implementations. So these are using Imagination Tech's PowerVR G6400 and G6430. And that's maybe not totally surprising, but a little bit surprising because, you know, we had always been told by Intel that they were able to get their graphics system down to these super lower power envelopes. And clearly, when it came down to these extreme power envelopes, they were much more comfortable going back with a graphics technology that is well known in the industry, has, you know, great driver support for Android, things like that. It's also happens to be the same graphics base design, the G6400 that's used in the iPhone 5S. And I think there's another major well-known SoC that is using the same PowerVR based spec. But, you know, it's interesting to see them kind of go back in that direction. We didn't see that I know of any announcements of specific products being made on these two parts, but they are saying handsets and tablets available by Q2. there are some benchmarks that Intel provided during the announcement that you can go see up at pcpro.com that looks at one that looks at graphics performance, one that looks at web application performance, more CPU based benchmark, but they're all provided by Intel. So take that for what you will. They're probably reasonably close. They're probably just a curated subset of what, you know, reviewers and hardware editors would actually throw at it. So keep that in mind as well.
Yeah, I was going to say the new chip not available for examination and the benchmarks show how it beats everything that's currently available.
I mean, they're fair. For example, in the GFX bench, the graphics bench, you know, they say we beat the Apple A7 on the iPhone 5S, but we actually do not beat the Snapdragon 800 in the Galaxy GS4. You know, so it's very close in that regard. But then, like, the web expert benchmark, they're faster than the A7. They're dramatically faster than the Snapdragon 800. They do talk a little bit about potential for 64-bit performance. Now, on this, they're just comparing their implementation with 32-bit and theirs with 64-bit on Android. I don't think there are any official 64-bit Android benchmarks yet because the kernel isn't actually operating in 64, or the kernel can, but the user space can't, something like that. So they had to hack around some things to even run a couple of tests, but they're seeing anywhere from like 14 to 34% of potential performance improvement with the move to 64-bit. And obviously bragging about this because their SoC supports 64-bit today, as soon as Android supports 64-bit. But I don't hold my breath
on that.
The whole 64-bit thing is weird. And as soon as Apple released the A7 with 64-bit support, it became this race from all the other ARM partners. And even when you talk to ARM, they're kind of like, we could start shipping, our partners could start shipping 64-bit, you know, ARM V8 ready SoCs, you know, next quarter. But what's the point if Android's, you know, roadmap puts 64-bit in the first quarter of 2015 or whatever it happens to be, right? So people will use that. It's kind of interesting to see the specification war that I'm used to seeing on the PC side also existing on SoCs with 8-core processors announced and 64-bit processing being a thing.
At least you can build a system, you know, with a PC or Windows or an OS X PC that will actually require and take advantage of 64-bit computing. I don't know. AMD Catalyst 14.2 beta version 1.3 driver released, coinciding with the launch of Thief, the game developed by Eidos Montreal and published by Square Enix, is another entry in the Gaming Evolved and their Never Settle promotion. Soon it will also support Mantle and True Audio. Optimizations for both single GPU and Crossfire customers for Thief, fixes for other titles, especially quote Battlefield 4, which can now run Mantle with up to 4 GPUs, which is pretty freaking awesome. Battlefield 3 and 4 also supports frame pacing on very high, greater than 2560 by 1600 resolution monitors, and dual card Crossfire fixes a couple of bugs in using Crossfire with DirectX 9 games, because, you know, sometimes you just got to run stuff that's years old. Missing textures in Minecraft, corruption in X-Plane for the win. Scott Ruth is up for PC Per, and the beta driver is available now at AMD's website. So now I want to download X-Plane.
Whatever brings it up, right? Yeah.
It's I'm not even going to go down that rat hole because I'll be gone for days. X-Plane is just so awesome. Questions, people. We love your questions.
I missed it. I don't know what's happening.
Can you hear that?
No.
Oh, I know what just happened. I open up the X-Plane window on my desktop, and I was hearing the control tower and the plane taking off, and I thought someone in the brick house was on for
you
my
thought music. They were okay. Gotcha.
I was hearing voices in my head, but they were actually on my PC and in my headphones. Questions we were talking about. Twitch, twit.tv is the email address. And chat room, fire them out if you've got a question for us. Oh, my goodness. That was really funny. That was really embarrassing. Eric writes in, I recently purchased a lightly used custom desktop. My main use for the computer is running virtual machines with VMware as part of my IT schooling. It came with the following core components: an AMD FX8120, Asus Sabertooth 990 FX motherboard, 4 gigs of RAM, Kingston HyperX T1 2000 megahertz running at 1600 megahertz, a Sapphire Radeon HC7870 Flex Edition. And he's wanted to upgrade the RAM after reviewing the qualified vendor list on the Asus website. He purchased 8 gigabytes of G-Skill Sniper Series 1866. He says, I installed the new G-Skill RAM in the 2 open slots. The computer recognized all 12 gigabytes, always a good feeling. In the BIOS, it changed the G-Skill to run at the stated 1866 speed and immediately got a blue screen of death. I pulled the Kingston RAM out and after some tweaking was able to get the machine stable running only the G-Skill at 1866. I am new to custom builds. I have little experience in modifying settings. What would you recommend I do? Just keep the G-Skill installed. Put the Kingston in 2 and run it all at 1600 megahertz. Can any damage be done by having different RAM types installed that run at different speeds? So faster RAM, at least it'll fit in the slot. Faster RAM will run at a lower speed. And, you know, we haven't talked about this in a few months, but generally speaking, memory speed is going to do the least for your overall noticeable day-to-day and or benchmarkable performance on almost every single test or application out there. So if it was me, I would want the giant memory space. I would want the 12 gigabytes a lot more than I would want 6 gigabytes running at 1866. Throttle it down to 1600, run it at 1600. I think you will be super happy. Doubling the amount of RAM you have for virtual machines is going to be a huge difference. The difference between running it at 1600 and 1866, I don't think you will be able to notice, even with the assistance of benchmarks. That's just me.
I mean, the blue screen that he got, to be honest with you, I don't. Maybe you can on some boards, but the idea of running 2 memory modules at 1600 and 2 of them at 1866, I don't think that's possible. And if it's possible, it's obviously not a good idea. I agree with you completely. Unless you're running an APU and doing gaming on it, like that's the only place where memory clock speed really makes a big difference. So I would install all 12 gigs and downclock it to 1600 megahertz. That's what I would do. Because the difference between 16 and 1866 is going to be negligible. But having more memory is always better. For sure.
Nicholas writes in, hey, Patrick and Ryan, I'm looking to try and upgrade my computer. I am running a Core i7-950, 12 gigs of DDR3, 1600 megahertz, the Gigabyte GA-X58AUD3R motherboard, and EVGA GTX 460 video card. Do you think I should upgrade everything, or could I get away with finding a better PCI Express 2.0 video card to replace the GTX 460? First of all, that's a slightly better system than I'm running. I split my 16 gigabytes of memory across a couple of systems, but I'm running a Core i7-920 for my primary gaming machine. And let me tell you, kids, upgrading to a brand new graphics card made a ridiculous difference. You know, will a PCI Express 3.0 card run on a PCI Express 2.0 slot, Ryan? Will evil angels fall from the sky and punish Nicholas in his sleep?
No. I hope not. I guess I'm not 100% sure of that. You can absolutely run a PCIe 3 card on PCIe 2. And in fact, I think you can run it all the way back to PCIe 1. I don't know what that'll do to performance necessarily. I would definitely try. I think we say this all the time, right? It's kind of repetitive, but if your option is replacing one product, like your graphics card, or replacing everything, start with that one product, right? Upgrade to a video card. And then if that's not enough, then you can go down and go to the rest of your system. But if I think what will happen is you'll install the video card and everything will be great. You'll be like, okay, well, now I can, you know, save my money for a little bit longer and see what happens in the, you know, hardware field over the next 6 months or a year before I get the upgrade itch again. Yeah, because, I mean, Alan, who writes for us, is still on a Core i7-920, like Patrick, I think you are. And he, I think he just recently upgraded to a GTX 680 card a few months ago. So, I mean, that's more than enough power to handle the graphics card. I think the story we talked about last week, where I took a GTX 750 Ti and plugged it into a dual core Pentium machine that I bought for $340 or $350, whatever, at Best Buy, proves that graphics card still more important than CPU for gaming tasks.
Funny you should bring that up, because Solaris7 in the chat room typed up, after you report on the NVIDIA $150 GPU, that's the TI Ryan just mentioned, it sounds like buying the top CPU is not needed for a gaming system. So at what point is a CPU good enough? That's kind of a loaded question, right? Because Ryan's experiment was taking super inexpensive $300, $500 pre-assembled systems straight from the shelves of Best Buy and dropping a 770 Ti GeForce. Was it a 770? It's just like a brain, but it's not working. Good. You're not automatically rattling it out too, so I feel better. You know, you need a balance between CPU and GPU power, right? If you're going to be running a $1,000 GPU, you probably want to be running a $600 or $1,000 CPU. That used to be sort of the rule of thumb, was spend about as much on your GPU as you do on your CPU. It's fudged a little bit, to use a highly technical term. But, you know, you need enough CPU to feed your GPU. You need enough GPU to take advantage of your CPU. And that's a balancing act that's become a lot less critical since GPU performance kept skyrocketing and monitors seem to be stuck for the vast majority of people out there at 1080p. And we've talked about that a bunch. But, like, you don't put a, you know, $600 GPU on your five-year-old $300 system. Conversely, you don't feed a $1,000 processor through, you know, the onboard graphics, unless, of course, you're basically doing nothing that requires 3D. And 3D gaming is kind of where 3D gaming and the size of your screen, the number of pixels on your screen, is where investing a lot of money in a GPU makes a huge difference. You know, there's a noticeable difference between a $150 GPU and a $300 GPU. The difference between a $600 GPU and a $900 GPU, or even a $400 GPU and a $900 GPU on a single 1080p desktop, not so noticeable. If you're running triple monitors, if you're running QXGA, if you want to feed, you know, sometime later this year, if you want to feed a 60 hertz 4K monitor, then you're talking about a place where the more expensive GPUs start to really show their stuff, which leads into Solaris 7. Can you get the same gaming experience with an AMD FX version top i7 with a 770 or 780? And I want to say no, but I may also be reading the chat room language improperly.
Can you get the same gaming experience with an AMD FX
versus a top Core i7?
Yeah, I mean, it kind of goes back into the previous question, right? I mean, I don't think anybody, I'm not going to tell you that CPU performance won't affect gaming performance at all, even up to a certain point. But GPU performance is much more important, right? And CPU performance, like for a high-end system, he's talking about with a 770 or 780, AMD versus Intel performance is going to be very similar. When you get into multi-GPU configurations, CPU performance can make a bigger difference. And there will be some performance differences, especially in terms of like frame latency and frame times, right? But I still think both the AMD FX and then Core i7 will be able to produce a good experience. One thing I just thought of on the previous point too is, even though when I use the upgrade of the 750 Ti across all these inexpensive systems, even though it drastically improved performance on each system still performed differently compared to each other after they had the discrete card installed. So there are still differences to be found. The point was, for $150, you can take even a really, really, really bad system like the Pentium and get workable performance out of it. If you have the Haswell-based system that we use in the article and put the same card in it, you're going to get better experience again, but again, even a little bit better than what you had with the Pentium or the, you know, the A10 system. So I think the same applies here. Just the differences will tend to compress and be a little bit smaller as you get towards that high end.
Yeah, Scott's hanging out in the chat room. He says, if you have very threaded applications, you can often get much better per dollar with AMD. Single-threaded apps will suffer, though, compared to an Intel. Caffeine-free Dave. Patrick, this new laptop you talked about at the start, is this your work computer or a review piece? It is a hand-me-down Lenovo Yoga that I've been playing around with, you know, and I've got a couple Dells coming in for evaluation, and I've been laughing as I've been bouncing between sort of a MacBook Air and the Yoga and this Dell that I can't really talk about and a couple other things, and having that moment where you realize that, you know, your thumb this far above the touchpad on this machine is okay, and this far above the touchpad on this machine is okay, and this far above the touchpad on this other machine made it go crazy. And it's just always, it's, you know, even after like 15 years of reviewing notebooks, it always amazes me how you still need that, you know, couple days or a week, or for some really unusual keyboard designs, a couple weeks to get your fingers to kind of up to speed. I type it like 70 or 80 words per minute. So, you know, an 88% keyboard with a couple tweaks on the locations of critical keys can drive me insane until, you know, I sort of remap everything in my head. So it's a work computer, but not a review piece.
It's interesting. Like I have my X230 that I use as my main machine, but like when we do videos here, we have a specific laptop that will sit on this desk now, and it will be only used for that purpose. We don't have other applications on it, and there's no risk of, you know, private information coming out. And its function key is in a little bit different place, and its control key is in a different place, and it's because that's going to be a full-time thing for me. Like, it's never going to get fixed because I'm always going between this Lenovo and that main gear or that whatever machine or the keyboard at my desk that is very different, right? So there's a lot of benefit to kind of sticking with one input control device. You can get much faster and more efficient.
A funny side conversation in the chat room. Taylor Karras, do you think GPU Skype video recorders exist?
GPU Skype video recorders?
Yeah, it's funny. I want to say Skype started with Skype 5.0 and higher used Microsoft DirectX. But yeah, I've never entirely. I prefer to think that Skype is just profoundly inefficient and handling video. Therefore, it wants to flatline as many cores of your CPU as possible. But it will take advantage of your GPU drivers on that. You know, always make sure that you've got like the latest version. Basically, make sure when your operating system updates are in place, make sure you have the latest GPU drivers from your manufacturer, whether it's Intel or AMD or NVIDIA. And then cross your fingers and make offerings to whatever god or gods you believe in, because that's kind of the critical thing in getting Skype to behave in any sort of situation.
And don't randomly use Windows 8.
Yeah. Well, you know, and don't be surprised as soon as you update Skype or update Windows that strange and powerful things are going to happen. One last chat room comment before we go. Dare I do that?
Sure.
Where did it go? Oh my goodness, chat room. It's funny. I'm like trying to close the Skype window and pressing the wrong side of the button on the laptop that I'm not used to yet. There it is. McButterpants says, Patrick, what is the difference between 4K and a Retina display? And is 4K worth it over Retina? Retina displays are, and it's an Apple marketing term for a very, very, very pixel dense display. It crams a ton of pixels per inch. 4K is primarily going to be used as something on a desktop or a HDTV or ultra HDTV. Retina displays, I think, look gorgeous. The high resolution display, whether it's a Cat Leap, you know, 2560 by 1440 displays we've been talking about on the show. Or Monoprice, if you don't want to, you know, order a drop shipped monitor from Korea via eBay. And I can understand why somebody might not want to do that. Monoprice is offering them. I'm not a huge fan. You know, the video, your video collection is going to look fine in a 4K display running at 30 hertz. Gaming is not going to look so okay. Computing, you're either going to like it or not like it. Mr. Shrout will tell you, as soon as you get up to 60 hertz on a desktop display, you are basically going to hold on to that monitor on loan from Asus until they fly somebody out to beat your ass silly with a baseball bat before you'll give it up.
Yeah, that's true.
So for me, you know, Retina is an Apple thing and it looks gorgeous, but Retina is essentially Apple's way of saying super high resolution, badass monitor that looks freaking gorgeous when you hold it. 4K is sort of the industry term for UHD. We can get into a whole lot of arguments over the finer points of what 4K is, but I am telling everybody, you know, on HD Nation, on Techzilla, and right here on This Week in Computer Hardware, that I would hold off on 4K until 60 hertz is available. I'm not the biggest fan of 30 hertz 4K. And if you're a gamer, you will hate 4K at 30 hertz. You will get that big, beautiful monitor home and you'll be really pissed off. It's one of the nice things about, you know, it's kind of funny, right? Samsung's doing these insane $40,000, like 100-inch UHD or 4K monitors. They're gorgeous. And they made sure that they put a box on the back with all the interesting electronics inside of it that can be upgraded so that, you know, if you're going to spend $40,000 for a monitor, you're going to be really pissed off when the next monitor comes out and it's running at 60 hertz. So what Samsung did is they basically built a module that you can upgrade. God knows how much it'll cost, but you'll be able to upgrade that module and move on to the higher frequency level when it's available, which I think is pretty smart. You know, and also I think if you can get people to spend $10,000 or $40,000 for a monitor, you probably want them to spend that money again in a few years, assuming they're still rich and stuff. But yeah, white guy, 4K is a spec, Retina is not. It's a marketing term. Mac Pro 4K monitor option for the new Mac Pro. You know, if you can afford the Mac Pro or the monitor that goes with it, tell me all about how awesome it is, because I look at the specs and I look at those boxes and I think, wow, that's a lot of money. Can you view 4K footage on the Retina display? I'm not even going to get into that right now. Yeah, it's my parents got the 4K Sony 65 inch. It is HDMI 2.0, supposedly. Very cool PC Per fan. Let me know how that works out. It's really, really interesting. Because it's there's this transition, and I think, you know, this is one of those cases where, and for most people, it's going to make more sense for a 4K desktop for their computer. It's going to make a lot more sense than 4K in the living room, at least until there's a bunch of 4K content available. Oh, yeah. One last one, since Tinker Toy Tech asked so nicely and just asked a second time. Patrick Ryan Shrout, what should I replace my 6950 with? I'm looking at a 3 to 4 gigabyte card as I run 3 monitors and a TV. And he would like to run a TV off a 2600K CPU.
The processor's fine. He's replacing a 6950, which is a fairly high-end card. He's got 3 monitors. If he's using all 3 of them for gaming, like if he's doing iFinity, I guess, then, I mean, 6950 is a high enough performance card that I really think he needs like an R9 290 to see like a dramatic increase in performance with that. You know, 290 would be the best card. That's unfortunately where things are expensive right now, right? The AMD cards are still up there in pricing, which is unfortunate. I want to say I had an interesting I went to Best Buy this week, and they had some two R9 280Xs in stock for basically MSRP pricing, because Best Buy is a huge corporation. They don't really pay attention to the huge pricing spikes. I'm going on there. It doesn't look like Best Buy has any 290s at all anywhere. So I just made that up. That's not going to help him any. You know, if he's not against AMD or against NVIDIA parts, even though he had a 6950 before, I would say the GTX 780 would be a good solution for that as well. It'd still be able to run three monitors and surround, if that's what he wants to do, and run the fourth display. So
I like what Tinker Toy Tech responded in the chat room. In other words, use it till it burns out. Not a bad idea.
Yeah,
idea at all.
Yeah. I mean, if you like 6950, move up to like a 7950, that's okay upgrade. Right. I mean, it would be an upgrade, but you're not going to see a huge jump in performance, right? So if it's something where you're like, I want to see an increase in performance, right, especially if you're gaming on three monitors, then you're going to have to buy the expensive hardware for it. And unfortunately, the expensive hardware just happens to be more expensive than it should be. I just looked on Newegg, and the cheapest R9 290 is $549, which is $150 over.
I was hoping the Mt. Gox crash, the Mt. Gox failure in security, the Mt. Gox screw up was going to start bringing down the prices of the 270, the 290. But apparently, people are still Bitcoining like mad, or working on some of the other digital currencies. So
yep. So you can get a GTX 780 for less money, and it's going to be a faster performing card. So,
right, ladies and gentlemen, that will draw this episode of This Week in Computer Hardware to a close. Per Ryan's request, I'm going to introduce next week's episode with a very low level of expectation. So I'm going to thank you all for listening. Remind you all to check out Techzilla and HD Nation and Dietrion. And of course, make all of your computer PC buying decisions after consulting the gurus at PCPer.com. And I want to thank you all for listening to this very unhyped podcast. I'm Patrick Gordon.
I'm Ryan Stroud.
We'll see you next week on Twitch.